Welcome to the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting. This is the first of the session, 2010. And because the meeting is shorter, I'm going to change the order of things here. The LEC did hear the resource assessment plan study before. I'd like you also to hear it again, but we're going to start with the transmission adequacy report today. And I know this looks like a lot of reading, but all of these reports were sent to you electronically earlier, within the last month or so, and we're just providing hard copies today. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senators, given the change in batting order, what I thought I would do is just introduce Mariah White and then let her take over for the transmission report.
Okay. So I did Mr. Glahn, just introduce yourself, please.
Oh, thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, I am Bill Glahn, Director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, but I believe I am in front of you this afternoon as the Acting Reliability Administrator, who was actually the entity charged with preparing this transmission report. So with that, because I can't help myself, I'm going to do one slide and then introduce Mariah White. And I actually will have to give credit to Terry Grove of Great River Energy. I stole this slide from a presentation that he made last week. I was on a panel with a couple of speakers, including Mr. Grove, in front of the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition. It's a Metro Counties group. And this, I thought, was a very interesting slide about load growth and transmission investment over the last few decades. Terry Grove works on the CapEx 2020 project, which is why their logo is in the bottom corner. But it shows that summer demand growth has been a fairly steady trend upward. As you'll notice, it only cuts off the first few years of the 2000s. We've seen an actual decline in summer load the last couple of years, with the economy being weak as well as the summers being rather mild. But the overall trend is fairly unmistakable, that peak summer load has continued to grow decade in, decade out, but our transmission investment has not kept pace. You can see from the 1970s, we had quite a few high-voltage projects in the upper Midwest. As you'll recall, the ones in Minnesota were quite controversial, and as a result of that, we made a number of changes in our siting law. But because of a number of factors, including economic and regulatory and whatnot, we have seen the pace of investment in transmission drop off dramatically from that peak of the 1970s to where there was some investment in the 1980s. This is showing no investment in the 1990s, although I'm sure there were some smaller projects that were built. And again, some investment here in the 2000s. And as we move forward, we believe we're going to need quite a bit more investment in our transmission infrastructure to ensure the reliability that we've come to enjoy the last few decades, as well as accommodate the growth that has already occurred in our population and energy usage, as well as accommodate the growing renewable energy industry that we have here in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. And with that, I'll introduce Mariah White from my staff. Mariah White works in the Reliability Administrator area, and she will take you through the next study and then whatever you want to hear after that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. White.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. That's actually a perfect introduction to my presentation on the Transmission Adequacy Report. This report was, we were charged with this report per Minnesota Statute 216-CO-54 as an annual report, a non-technical report annually to the legislature. And the statutes talk about having us present information on four bullets: the transmission needed in the next 15 years, efforts made to meet the need, status of transmission proposals, and barriers to meeting the need. And I'm hoping that I hit the right arrows here. There we go. Our first report was filed on January 15th, and because it was our first report, we thought we would give you some background on how we got to here. Transmission and energy service has been in Minnesota since the very early 1900s. 1920s, 1930s, REA came in, our Rural Electric Association federal program came in the 30s to 40s. Since that time, we have had energy service or electricity service in Minnesota. The report starts out by talking about how transmission historically has been planned, constructed, and operated. After we've gone through that, we'll talk about a couple of governmental actions that actually changed the way historically transmission was created. And then we'll get into transmission today as well as what's being planned for the future. Transmission, I say in the 20th century, that's a loose term, but it's more like historically. Transmission historically was what we call vertically integrated. That was the utilities owned the power plants, then they owned the transmission lines to bring the power from the power plants to their customers, and then they distributed among their customers in the cities or wherever their customers were. That's historically what they did. They planned for their customers' usage at the time, as well as they knew what was going on, the technologies of the time, and they constructed and they operated for their own customers. As technologies advanced and customers' and their usage increased, then they had to take that into account into their planning. Commissioner Glahn talked about customer numbers increased as well as their usage increased throughout the 1990s. The governmental actions that I talked about are two major ones, one federal and one state. In the late 1990s and the 2000s, the federal government, this is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission mostly, determined that the electric grid, not only in Minnesota and the region, but the country, is an interstate commerce entity for the public benefit, and as such came under federal jurisdiction, and they opened up the electric grid, which means that now the utilities who owned transmission and operated and planned transmission, it wasn't just for their customers anymore. They had to allow anyone who wanted to generate and deliver power to someone else could use the grid openly. So that complicated things for providing energy to customers. State mandates, not only in Minnesota, but in I think it's 40 of the 50 states right now have some kind of renewable energy mandate of some type. This also changed the way that utilities planned, constructed, and operated as well, because now they had to consciously make sure that a certain percentage in Minnesota, of course, it's 25% by 2025 with milestones along the way, have to come from renewable sources. So that complicated the utilities work as well, primarily because renewable sources, the best resources, are not necessarily where the transmission lines are. In fact, the best renewable sources in Minnesota are in primarily rural agricultural farming areas, which historically the transmission was sized to provide electricity to farms. So the transmission lines in that area were historically not built very big. They were built just big enough to provide energy to the farms. They weren't built big enough to provide hundreds to thousands of megawatts of wind energy in those best resource areas and deliver it to other areas. Beyond that, the last bullet that talks about the complications is that now when utilities have to plan, and operate and construct transmission, it's not only for their customers, which they know their customers' usage, and they can pretty much figure that out in the future, but they also have to assume that others will use their grid, and they have to plan for usage by others, even though they may not know who the others will be and how much they will want to use in any particular time. So that complicates matters, too. So all of this leads to all of this uncertainty that we have, not only about opening up the grid and allowing others to use it, as well as being unsure about how much usage any part of transmission will get, and we're talking about into the future, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years into the future, makes for a lot of uncertainty, but it also has generated a lot of planning processes. Which is the responsible thing to do. Of course, no one knows the future, but what all these planning processes do, make all the parties come together, provide what information they can, provide what expert thoughts and opinions that they can on how they see the future unfolding, and put all this together and look at some different models, some different what-if scenarios and things like that to put together into a planning process. We have a number of them, going on today. The utilities in our state and around the region are all involved in these. We have the Renewable Energy Standard Transmission Study, and this is in state. The utilities file this with the commission along with their biennial report, which is the last bullet every other year. On November 1, they just filed their latest one on November 1 of this last year. The bottom line for their RES transmission report filed by the utilities is that they feel that they have planning sufficient to reach the 2016 up to 2020 milestones. They've already initiated planning processes to get from the 2020 milestones to the full 20 to 25 milestones. So they're very actively working and collaborating together, the utilities, to work on that. We also have the Dispersed Renewable Generation Study, Phases 1 and 2, which you have heard about before. We've brought reports to you about that. That is a legislative study that you charged us with doing. And I have a few slides on that right after this report, so we can talk a little bit more about that. And then every other year along with the RES transmission report, the Minnesota utilities collaboratively file a large transmission projects report to the commission. And this can be very, very small projects, which are just like changing out some wire that is old and needs to be, changed out because it might not be quite reliable anymore. It might be updating some things. It might be changing out some poles that are cracking. It could be just little things like that, all the way up to very big projects. So these planning efforts and reports are going on. We also have our utilities involved in regional planning. A number of efforts in that respect, along with the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator, which is Midwest ISO or MISO, is looking at a massive study, the Regional Generator Outlet Study. That this industry loves acronyms, so they call it RGOS, but it's the Regional Generator Outlet Study. And what they have done is they look at all the states, such as Minnesota, that have renewable mandates, and they estimate how much renewable energy they will need for those mandates. And then they will look at planning transmission to ensure that those states can get the renewable energy they need so their utilities in their states can fulfill their mandates. That's basically, in a nutshell, what the Regional Generator Outlet Study does. Phase one looked at Minnesota, the two Dakotas, Iowa, Wisconsin, parts of Illinois, and parts of Indiana. And then phase two is now looking at the other eastern states in MISO's footprint, which is basically the rest of Indiana, the rest of Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, and the edge of Pennsylvania, northern Kentucky, and northern Missouri. This is in the works right now. In fact, and we're holding meetings on it. There was one yesterday talking about this, so this is actively being planned. As it goes along, if you would like reports or more information on this, we can certainly bring you that. A separate study that's going on at the same time is called the SMART Transmission Study, and I'm sorry, I can't tell you what the SMART stands for. This is a different group of utilities, including Commonwealth Edison, which serves Chicago, which is actually not even in the Midwest ISO. It's in the Midwest ISO's sibling organization to the east, which is PJM, and I think it stands for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, but don't hold me to that. Commonwealth Edison is a major driver in this. American Electric Power, which serves parts of Ohio, which is also in PJM, is part of this. American Transmission Corporation, which has the transmission in Wisconsin, is part of this, and Xcel Energy have all gotten together and collaborating on this separate study, which is looking at a lot of the same things that the Regional Generator Outlet Study is looking at, but from a different footprint, even though we use that's kind of a jargon term, but it's a different, we're looking at those utilities' service territories, cumulative. Excuse me. States, more regional planning. The states meaning state regulators, state policymakers are also very involved in these planning efforts. The utilities are, but the states are as well, and stakeholders are. The Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiative, this is Minnesota and its four neighboring states, are looking into transmission planning. And other issues, which I'll get into in a minute. That is primarily state regulatory commissions and staff are working on this. We are collaborating with Midwest ISO and utilities, looking at regional generator outlet study, the Argos stuff from the last slide, and seeing what's best just for our five states. And reach in and providing primarily Minnesota and Wisconsin's RES goals. The states also have their own initiative going on with cost allocation and resource planning, which their acronym is CARP, only because I think the commissioner who is chair of this group loves to have acronyms that are words. This is a separate, this is the 15 states in the MISO footprint. This is state regulators are collaborating. In fact, there's a meeting going on right now. I left that meeting to come down here to give this presentation to look into planning issues for their states and to look into the regional generator outlet study and how it impacts their states, and then also to look at cost allocation, which I'll come back to in a minute. Okay, now we're to the part with, this is transmission today and the part going forward. Remember the statute says that it charges us with looking at transmission challenges and looking at transmission into the future. We are all involved, utilities primarily, Midwest ISO, Minnesota regulators are all looking at the Joint Coordinated System Plan. That actually was put together under the auspices of the Department of Energy a year and a half ago, which actually, in a nutshell, a Joint Coordinated System Plan looked at building very large voltage transmission from our area to deliver renewable power to the East Coast. And that has kind of, it was done, the study was done. It generated a lot of comment from the East Coast states, especially in the New England states and New York. They didn't like the premise so much of getting Midwest wind to their states. They felt that they wanted to develop their own sources. Department of Energy and the National Renewable Energy Lab, two federal agencies, launched the Eastern Wind Integration and Transmission Study to do exactly that. They looked at all of the wind resources in each of the states in the Eastern Interconnect, which is basically the edge of Montana down to Texas and east. And they looked at siting wind farms in each of the states that had any wind resource, as well as delivering wind from a long-term, from far away. They found that the eastern states who wanted to site wind onshore and especially offshore on the eastern seaboard, there is quite a bit of resource, of course, if they want to site it out in the water. But that did not mean that they could then not use transmission from the Midwest to the east in order to keep the whole grid stable. Between the Eastern Interconnect, they still needed transmission. Like you're going to stop me.
Yeah, this is all interesting, and I can tell that it's very elaborate and that you've had to review a number of studies. But I'm wondering if you can get to the effect on Minnesota in terms of transmission adequacy and cost allocation and things like that.
Let's go to this one. Let's just start with the challenges, and this is going to be Minnesota as well as anything else, but I think we can just talk about Minnesota challenges. Any new federal or state renewable mandate is going to increase the pressure on the grid and increase the pressure on developing renewable generation in Minnesota and especially in the Midwest.
Now, before you go further, I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
I'm not sure I understood correctly. Was it the federal legislation or was it Minnesota legislation that opened up our lines to other transmission?
Certainly, Madam Chair, members, it was actually federal jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has determined that transmission actually is under federal jurisdiction. However, FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has stated more than once that if the states are proactive and productive about planning and constructing transmission in their states, that they will not make a concerted effort to try to preempt what the states are doing.
Okay.
So that's kind of where it stands, and they are very actively watching all these planning processes, in fact, involved with all these planning processes, and so far have made noises that they're happy about them. So that's where it stands right now, but it's actually federal.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. For the first bullet, I wanted to just add that not only does this put more pressure on the grid and put more pressure on developing resources, but the very best resources in the U.S. are actually in the Dakotas. And we are kind of right in front of the Dakotas if they want to send energy east. So even if the resource development was in the Dakotas, there would still have to be transmission built through Minnesota or the state south of us to get the transmission east. So that's the direct impact on Minnesota.
And who owns that transmission?
Utilities will propose it and construct it. And then they will, after they've done that, they will get revenues from whoever uses it. The second bullet talks about transmission placement. This is not news to you. Last year there was already talk about land concerns regarding land use and land rights or environmental impacts. We have processes going. Our energy facility permitting process between my agency and the Public Utilities Commission deals with this all the time. And then the last one is the federal to state jurisdiction, and this is your question, Madam Chair, that about it's actually federal jurisdiction, and there's also the threat of preemption if the federal government decides to do that. The overall challenge for transmission, by far, the very largest challenge for transmission right now is allocating the costs. Allocating costs of transmission needs to look at who benefits from the transmission or who causes the transmission costs to be incurred. Those are the people who should be charged the costs. If I will just say ratepayers or whoever, if they do not receive benefits from the transmission cost, from the transmission being built, is it fair to charge them? You'd think this would be a fairly straightforward question. It's not. It's incredibly complicated, and that's really what a lot of these planning processes are struggling with right now. There are two groups primarily who are working almost full-time on this. One has to do with MISO stakeholders. A number of stakeholders are wrestling with this, and the other one is the CARP process by the state regulators.
Now, are they looking for a national resolution to this, or is it a regional?
This is a regional for the states in the MISO footprint. So it's the 14 states in the MISO footprint. I will tell you that the last thing about this slide that I just wanted to add was not only are the utilities and the stakeholders in the states all working on this very hard, we actually have FERC staff attending these processes. The FERC staff who attend these meetings, they attend all the meetings. They're here now in town attending the meetings. They write briefings to their commissioners, the federal commissioners. So the federal commissioners are very much aware of what's going on with this. In summary, I can tell you, according to what the statute has us to do, right now the utilities are planning or have plans in place to make sure that they meet their 2016 to 2020 RES goals, and I use that range because we don't know what the economy is going to do. It looks at what the usage levels are, and the economy has depressed usage levels. So if the economy in the future continues to depress usage levels, our transmission would probably go on or would be good to go for probably up to 2020. If the economy comes back and the usage levels come back, we'll need more transmission faster. Today, the transmission grid is fully used. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. Everybody is into lots of planning off processes are going on. Almost all of these processes, in fact, all of them that I'm aware of or involved with, all are looking to deliver renewable power. That's the focus, is on delivering renewable power. They all have challenges involved, and the greatest challenge is the cost allocation, who to charge. Now, that's the end of my transmission adequacy report.
Okay. If for transmission lines that run through Minnesota and don't stop here but are carrying perhaps wind energy to states east of us, is there any benefit that accrues to ratepayers in Minnesota as a result of that?
There may be benefits, and actually, I can talk a little bit about that in the dispersed renewable generation. There's likely benefits because most transmission lines will shore up and make a transmission grid more what they call robust or just more stable and more relieve congestion in specific places. So there's some benefits, but this is one of my personal biggest concerns involved in this thing is that I don't want Minnesota customers, and none of us do working in this. We don't see that Minnesota customers should end up paying a large chunk of the bill for transmission that just runs through our state. We get some benefits, but it's not, we're not the primary beneficiaries.
Are we paying for it?
Are we paying for it? We will probably pay some, but we are getting some benefits. So that's the challenge that we're going through right now and trying to sort out.
And what kind of benefit would we receive?
Right now, because our transmission grid is so constrained around the state, that if transmission comes through and has some open capacity or can relieve a constraint on part of our grid to open up some capacity that we can put some wind energy in, or we can take off some wind energy for our customers, that would be a benefit. In fairness, we should pay something for that benefit, but we should not be paying a big chunk for all of the transmission just because it's sitting in our state.
Okay.
And you would be surprised.
Go ahead.
Oh, and you would be surprised that not all states agree with that. They'd be happy
the ones that are receiving it, I suppose.
Yes, they'd be happy to have Minnesota pay a big chunk for that.
That raises a question, though, about the reliability of our grid. And is there the potential that we aren't going to have sufficient energy and that we'll have brownouts or whatever? And I don't know if you want to answer that at this time or if you'll be addressing that at some other point.
Madam Chair and members, I have not heard anything that would lead me to believe that we will have brownouts. I don't think that our grid is broken. That's not a good word, but I don't think it's weak enough that we would have brownouts. We just don't have enough available capacity to handle all of the wind turbines that are coming online, frankly. And that's, we like developing the wind turbines. We just don't have the transmission capacity to deliver the power. That's our big challenge right now, is to look at developing transmission so the wind turbines can.
Are there other sources of energy that could be turned down as wind comes on board?
The answer is yes. But that's my own personal opinion. If you ask a utility that, they might say something different. They are always looking at, for example, their older plants or every utility has older plants, smaller plants, larger plants, cleaner plants. They have a whole mix of plants. And they're looking at their portfolio of plants to see what they can, what they call back down, which is basically turn them down. And supplant that with wind energy. But remember, wind energy is intermittent energy. So we still have to be careful that we don't mess up the stability of the power flows on the grid because of the intermittent nature of the power. We have to make sure that we've got some steady baseload power in there just to keep the grid stable.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. White. Would you explain to me this grid that the benefit that you're talking about, that there be some freeing up on the grid that Minnesota ratepayers ought to be paying for? That original grid, who paid for that?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the ratepayers in the state paid for the original grid, but what I'm talking about is new projects coming online. The new projects, and that's what I'm talking about with cost allocation and things. This is looking at cost allocation of new projects that haven't been built yet. And that's what I'm talking about, that Minnesota customers should not have to pay for a big chunk of new projects. They should fairly pay for the benefits that they get, but they should not, just because the line is located in Minnesota, have to pay a big chunk.
For projects, you're referring to new transmission lines.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Sharon.
Well, who will determine the distribution of that share of the rates?
Madam Chair.
Ms. White.
Senator Sharon, actually, that's a federal jurisdiction. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission actually makes that decision.
One more follow-up question. I would just simply say, I don't know who's arguing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, but if we've already paid for the original grid and then have to pay again some portion because we get the benefit of having some of it back and not utilized by others, that seems to be a very confabulated argument for charging us again for the use of a grid we originally paid for.
Ms. White, does the state have the authority to make sure that our ratepayers aren't taken advantage of?
Madam Chair and members, the authority that we have is, first of all, the state has retail rate authority for distribution rates. The authority that we have for wholesale rates is more along the lines of the authority to intervene in any federal Energy Regulatory Commission proceeding or docket and make our wishes known. But we do that as a party to whatever the docket is. And we do. I mean, we have filed comments in a number of federal dockets for that purpose.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. White, my question is about the grid and the lines in Minnesota. Have we done all, I don't know if you can answer this thoroughly, but maybe you can give me a percentage of, are there any lines that can be upgraded to a higher KV? Have we done all the retrofitting, replacing of the new wires? Is there something we could do with the existing lines already in place to perhaps meet our need on the renewable side?
Madam Chair?
Ms. White.
Senator Rosen, I think that's a very good idea, and yes, the utilities are all looking at that. One of the things is when they upgrade a transmission line to a larger voltage, bigger transmission line, a lot of times that they need another wider right-of-way to do that. So, in fact, a lot of the proceedings that the commission has before it for certificates of need and for routing transmission lines is looking at widening the right-of-way because that, again, they have to go to landowners and they have to look for like that extra 50 feet beside the existing right-of-way. They have to widen it because there's federal standards, electricity standards, and some of them are the widths of the right-of-ways. So the utilities have to comply with those. In fact, a lot of our majority probably of our certificates of need proceedings going on right now have at least partially rebuilding and upgrading existing transmission lines.
So, Ms. White, can you put into the certificate of need the protection of your ratepayers, or can you deny a certificate of need if you feel the ratepayers are being taken advantage of?
The whole premise of the, Madam Chair and members, the premise of the certificate of need is that the project is needed for the public interest in the state. So I think,
even if it's not in the state, it's in Wisconsin or
right.
Illinois.
Madam Chair and members, the certificate of need statute allows for regional public interest as well as state public interest. If a utility proposed a project that was not beneficial to their own customers, I would think that the commission would have the authority to deny such a project, but I'm not an attorney, so I can just give you my own personal opinion.
But isn't that the case of many of these, or I don't know many, but a line or some that might be going through Minnesota to other states? I mean, what benefit would a utility propose it was providing to the state?
Madam Chair, members, I think that's when we have to get into looking at the benefits to the state and to the state's citizens, and then it gets back to the cost allocation problem, that the cost that they get charged should be in proportion to the benefits that they would get from this new project. And that's what we're wrestling with.
Senator Spark, did you have a question? Okay. Okay, thank you. Senator Sharon.
This issue that we're talking about right now is when the benefactor of the new resource is not within the state. Does that same authority apply that you can refuse a permit if the benefactors of a development and the transmission lines that would be needed for it do not benefit another within the state, between counties, between regional jurisdictions?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, between counties, I'm not sure about, because the commission's authority is a statewide authority, so I'm not sure if they can differentiate among beneficiaries or cost causers or those who don't benefit on a county by county basis. I'm just not sure of that. I do know that for routing transmission line purposes, that and for generation projects, small generation projects or small projects, counties can have can take over routing or siting authority on small projects themselves. There is a statute on the books that allows them to do that,
and they can do that outside their own jurisdiction. The counties can do that outside of their county jurisdiction?
Madam Chair and members, I don't believe so. I think their jurisdiction is only within the boundaries of their county.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. White, I guess as I read through some of this, I'm really not understanding all as I'm looking at some of the things we're doing around the country. So I'm wondering, when we're looking at these new generation lines and things that may go through the state and the benefits, are we thinking long-term about that grid, about exit and entry points on the, for example, wind? I mean, we understand you can't just hook up wind anywhere. And as solar comes online and we look at other biomass or other things, I guess that might speak to, if we just put a set of lines that run through Minnesota, that if we can, you know, dump some more energy on the line or in the future take it off and hook it to a smart grid city or something, is that all in the equation?
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
White.
Senator, yes, it is. That's all part of the of looking at being able to develop not only wind but renewables. A lot of times when we're talking about developing, we talk about renewables. We don't really talk about wind per se. We may use wind as a like a proxy because it's by far the largest type of renewable we have right now, but it's not precluding other types at all. Madam Chair, and members, I have just a few slides on the dispersed renewable generation. I believed you wanted to hear a little bit about that. This first slide just reminds you that Next Generation Energy Act of 2007 charged us with doing this. There's a phase one and a phase two, and those are the dates that the reports were filed. Phase one was charged to identify 40 megawatt sized renewable projects for a total of 600 megawatts. They did so, although they found that there were a number of congested areas in the state, so they could not evenly disperse them around the entire state. Most of them were located in southeast Minnesota and some in southwest Minnesota. That was phase one. Phase two built on the phase one work. Some of the assumptions from phase one were changed based upon the comments that we got from the phase one, or the assumptions for phase two were changed based upon the comments that we received from the phase one report. One of the things that phase one did not look at is all of the projects that are in the MISO queue. The engineers and experts in the work group worked on the phase two project looked at that and changed that and did put in a portion of the projects in the queue. that are right sitting in the queue right now, waiting to get interconnection agreements. And there were other assumptions. They also looked at actually smaller than 40 megawatt or 10 to 40 megawatt sites, just in case they found some much smaller sites. In fact, they identified some 5-megawatt sites. But even the 5-megawatt sites, they found some constraints. And then the bottom line here for the statute, they started with the 2013 modeling year, and they also, to start with, assumed that parts of the CapEx project and other transmission lines were built already. So they started with adding over $1 billion worth of transmission investment that doesn't exist today to start the project. Phase two initially identified a number of potential sites. Then they started looking at what they call limiters, and that can be absolutely anything. It can be equipment like capacitors or transformers that weren't big enough to do whatever they needed to do, which limited their ability to put transmission or put some generation at a location. It could be any number of things. That's why they're called limiters. They had a whole list of detailed transmission things. When the study was over, it found that in order to fix these smaller transmission and smaller limiters at a number of sites, in order to reach 600 megawatts, it would cost approximately $121 million to fix these small locations. So you can look at it that they started with over $1 billion worth of investment in the study that doesn't exist today, plus about $121 million would be needed to unlock some capacity to be able to site small projects around the state for a total of 600 megawatts. So that's the bottom line, basically, for the phase two dispersed renewable generation. Here are the conclusions from the phase two report. It looked at the lower and the higher voltage, the big transmission lines and the smaller transmission lines, both in their design. And they concluded, these are the experts and the engineers that did the study, concluded that both the lower voltage and the upper voltage are operating at their design capacity, which means they have available transmission to site small projects. In aggregate, they found that even small projects added together can impact not only the lower voltage but the higher voltage grid, and that a large amount of money will need to be built in order to free up dispersed projects. Just to give you an idea of what was in the queue during the study time period, 50,000 megawatts of primarily wind projects, renewable projects, were sitting in the MISO queue going through studies and waiting to get interconnection agreements. Right now, there are approximately 60,000 megawatts. So the queue line is actually getting bigger instead of smaller right now. Many of the sites identified in the report are already requested in the queue by different projects. And the last things are, in order to get through the queue, more study would have to be made. The study that was made in the reports was not sufficient enough to do that, and they didn't try to look at cost allocation. The engineers didn't. So that is my report.
So the question that arises is that we've had a number of these wind projects that have gotten caught up in situations where it's extremely costly for them, especially some of our seabed projects, to hook into the grid. Do you see a solution to that? And And are we going to get these projects moving?
Madam Chair and members, I certainly hope so. One of the things we're doing in the cost allocation processes that we're involved in is looking at changing how we charge any generator to interconnect to the system. So that right now, the way the MISO rules are, which is federally approved, those are federal tariffs, they have to abide by them, looks at a big upfront payment for studies and for interconnections. We're looking at changing that, whereas we would not have so much of an upfront money, but perhaps looking at charging them as they produce energy. Another thing, too, is please remember that one of the reasons that they are charged, and it's not only wind projects, but it's any generator that is looking to get to the queue. MISO is having to do so many handstands and studies to try to figure out how to fit in these projects into the transmission because there's really essentially no room for them, that it takes a lot of study to do that and maintain the viability of the grid without blacking out the lights. Once we ever get some transmission built that will start providing some space to be able to interconnect some generators, they won't have to study it so hard. And when they don't have to study it so hard, they don't have to spend so much money to study it. So hopefully that will lower the study bill for generators in the future once we get the transmission built. And it also should help with the queue.
And is it going to help those that are waiting now?
Well, we're, Madam Chair and members, we are actually working under a deadline, a federal deadline. I can't speak to individual projects because I don't know individual projects' timings. They're all different. I know that some are on a real tight time frame. I'm not sure. Excuse me. I can tell you that the federal government, that FERC has said that MISO will have a new cost allocation tariff filed by July 15th.
I think it's on the Brookings line that there's been these enormous cost overruns and continuous reassessments that have prohibited the seabed projects from coming
right.
online.
Yes. And that's I honestly can't tell you if each individual project will come out okay because I don't know their time frames. I can tell you that all of the stakeholders are working as fast as they can to come up with a solution to be able to meet this July 15th deadline.
And when you're talking about the stakeholders, you're talking about the regional group that's working?
Stakeholders in the state, stakeholders in the region, yes.
And when you talk about changing the process by which the cost allocation occurs, is that a federal change? What kind of a time frame do you think that will be?
Well, Madam Chair and members, that would be up to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They can move quickly if they get a lot of pushback from parties or opposition from parties. It may take months. I don't know how fast. I do know that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission understands the time frames and understands the pressures that are going on for generation projects and for reliability for transmission as well. I think they're going to move as fast as they possibly can simply because it's been made very clear to them from the states that something needs to be done. And I think they're positioning themselves to do that from what I've seen. But until it's filed, I don't know if they're going to be able to give us an answer any better than anybody else could.
Okay. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White and maybe members, if you can kind of help me on this one as well. Because I think sometimes we get in these arguments about whether, you know, you put the new base load of coal or natural gas and all these other renewable projects, but I think we don't ever get to see, or at least I'm not really seeing something that cuts to the chase in a report we can kind of get that says, if we do transmission here, or what are the real limiters in the different areas so we can understand. And I guess I don't really even know how to frame it, except that we don't know if wind and solar and biomass could really be effective if we don't have the right transmission, but we don't have that kind of a condensed version of a report that says if we put these kind of lines up, or these are the limiters in northern Minnesota, to disperse it and make some of these other alternative energy projects work and potentially be efficient, what are we really up against? And then on that base load as well. So is there a way to get, maybe more bullet points or something that we don't have to read through lengthy reports and then try to go, how does this piece fit with this piece and that piece and that piece? Because maybe I'm the only one on the committee that's not getting that, but I try to read everything I come across, and I just can't find something that cuts to the chase and gives me the true answers of how can we make these projects compete equally, and transmission seems to be the main obstacle to overcome.
Madam Chair, Senator, excuse me, Senator Jungbauer, I think you hit the nail right on the head, actually. It comes down to transmission by federal law has to treat all generators equally, whether they're renewable generators or coal generators or who they are, as far as allowing them on the grid to the extent that they can. So it just comes down to the point where we just don't have enough transmission to bring generators on, and I mean generators, any generators, on the system without encountering a number of limiters along the way. So the solution is we just need some transmission in the ground. And then different generators, different renewable resources, different renewable technologies can seek to interconnect and come into the market and, show their viability and show what they can do.
Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair, Ms. White, so is there a way to, as I'm kind of thinking through this, and if I look at biomass, for example, and in maybe areas of northern Minnesota, we'll just take it as an example, could be a great place to produce a very quick growth woody biomass to be able to generate. So if you took different scenarios from around the state, obviously Buffalo Ridge is great for wind, if we need generation there. So if we could even pick some scenarios to kind of play out around the state, what we think might be the best alternative option, and what are the limiters, and what kind of capacity do we need in generation, how that all plays back, because, sometimes we sit and argue about, again, the base load that we need there, but I think as well, no matter which side you're sitting on, you need the wind to be able to compete, and if it needs the generation to compete, or the biomass to compete, or what other processes are there, I, for one, want to make sure there's a fair way to compete and distribute them around the state. But I really kind of need to know what we need to cut through to get to that point and make it a fair comparison.
Ms. White.
Madam Chair and Senator, actually the way that the regional generator outlet study was conducted is that the states chose some areas of renewable generation. And it sounds like what you're looking at is something along that aspect where you would like to say, okay, let's consider that in the northern part of the state that we're going to have the resources to generate, 100 megawatts of biomass. The boss is coming. and then down on Buffalo Ridge, look at, generate 100 megawatts of wind. And then run some scenarios. I guess I'd have to talk to the utilities. They might have the capacity to do something like that.
Okay. But, Madam Chair, Ms. White, too, as well as we get into it, and I'll just use a scenario again. If everybody in St. Paul or Minneapolis drove a hybrid car plug-in that could be plug-in electric that could backfeed through the grid if it's not being used in terms of smart grid, again, how these pieces fit together, but in a scenario we're not reading through, all this good engineering stuff we can read through and it makes sense to a degree, but I think it's going to take a lot of components if we're really truly going to get to energy efficiency, which and or security, the way that I guess back in the Carter era we talked about overcoming our dependence on foreign, whether it's foreign oil or otherwise, we need to understand all the components necessary to really create that, to look at the picture holistically. And I think, I don't know, we keep getting these bits and pieces, and I'm putting them together, and it kind of makes sense because you only have enough money to do it a piece at a time, but maybe Bill has an answer.
Madam Chair, Senator, I was going to suggest that this discussion would be much better to have in the context of the resource assessment study, where I really think we're getting much closer to the exercise that you were discussing, to try to see how different kinds of resources would fit together along with transmission and demand reduction. And that was the exercise we tried to undertake in that study, which I would invite us to resume this discussion in when we have that that presentation.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Anderson.
We started. Madam Chair, thank you. Well, I'm having the same trouble, I think, Senator Jungbauer, is getting my head around all this information and figuring out what it really means in the big picture. I'm really struggling. So just a couple questions, I guess, about the dispersed renewable generation study. And I think what I understand your conclusions are, I think I understand it vaguely, generally, and you were looking at 600 megawatts because that was the universe we asked you to look at. But did you find any opportunity for small projects to interconnect at a lower cost and without straining the grid? Or, I mean, you said in aggregate there's too much. 600 small megawatts of small projects is too much for the grid as is right now, or as it would be in 2013. But how much could we do? And could we do some at a lower cost? And did you look at really small? I know that I was looking at George Krecker's memo about really small projects under 10 megawatts and whether you looked at those. That's
Ms. White.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, actually with phase one, they did identify a number of locations where they could interconnect dispersed projects in a total 600 megawatts without too much money. So phase one did actually do that. Then phase two was an additional 600 megawatts, and that's where they ran into the limiters, and it became much more difficult. And that's where they had to look at, with the $121 million that would be needed to fix limiters in order to site the additional 600 megawatts. But in phase one, they actually did, and I think that the vast majority, if not all of those sites that were located, that were identified in phase one, have been requested and by projects.
Requested, Madam Chair, what do you mean requested?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, projects have requested of MISO that they look at interconnecting their proposed project at the location that was identified in the report.
And so, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I should know this, but isn't a really small project doesn't have to get on the MISO queue? Isn't there a minimum size, or they all have to get on it?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if I remember correctly, it makes more of a difference to where it's located. If it's located on a distribution system, then it doesn't have to go to MISO at all. It goes to the utility that, and it could be a municipal utility, it could be co-op, whatever utility is serving that distribution system. I think it has more to do with where the project is located than actually the size of the project.
Okay. And I'm just thinking
Senator
about the,
Anderson.
Madam Chair, the 40 or 50,000 megawatts, I think you said, that are in the MISO queue right now. Those are for Minnesota. Those are Minnesota, or those regional
right.
projects?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that's actually region.
Okay.
That's in the region.
And is most of that wind?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I think it's almost all wind. At least for the western, at least for our area, it's almost all wind.
I mean, I thought, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
I'm just trying to put it in perspective of, I thought the renewable energy standard, when I'm the assumption I've always had, it's like 4,000 or 5,000 megawatts, something like that. Is that number all? Okay, Bill Grant's nodding. Good. Something in that range to meet that 25%. I mean, and that's really rough. It depends on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But so this is 10 times that amount.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, actually, that's right. There is multiples of not only Minnesota's renewable energy standard, but Wisconsin and Illinois and the other states. There's way more wind projects in the MISO queue right now than the MISO states would need to fulfill all their mandates.
Okay. So, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I'm wondering, what percent of the region's electricity would that represent, and what would it take to get all that wind put online? I mean, how much transmission in your estimation, or is that too difficult of a question? I'm trying to simplify this, and these things are not simple.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if I remember correctly, and I hope someone, Bob Cupid or somebody behind me, says something, I thought I recalled that the MISO footprint, all the states in the MISO footprint, their requirements, total energy requirements, is about 100,000 megawatts. So you're looking at 50%. I mean, if we interconnected all of the wind, which actually won't happen, a lot of projects drop out. But if you interconnected all of the wind that is currently in the queue right now, you would be at 50% of the entire MISO requirements. And that's one reason why they have to do such studying, because this is all intermediate energy or intermittent energy, and so they have to make sure that the grid is maintained and that they don't unbalance the whole grid with that intermittent energy.
Well, Madam Chair, it just makes me wonder what are the limit? I mean, obviously, transmission is a limiting factor. Where you put all these projects is a limiting factor. But if we were to overcome those, is there anyone saying there's a maximum amount of wind that we should build?
Ms. White. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, actually, there's a lot of study and technology that's getting better all the time about raising the limit, the amount of renewable energy, intermittent energy that can go on the grid. When we first started interconnecting wind turbines, we were really scared that if we put in 2%, we were going to unbalance the grid. And now they're finding out, as they do more study and have more experience, and they get faster computers, and they keep better records, and they're starting to look at things on a 2-second by 2-second basis. They're getting a lot more comfortable with interconnecting a lot more wind than we ever anticipated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
What's a lot more wind? the wind integration study went up to 25%. Are you talking about above that?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I have not heard a top limit. They know that, I do know that right now that MISO is looking at a scenario that would have a national RPS of 25%. So all of the states that don't have an RPS of our size would have to hike themselves up to that level, and some states would have to go from 0 to 25%. That's a whole lot of wind around the whole country. That would be huge, and they're studying that, and they're just starting to study it now. But I haven't heard anybody just off the cuff saying, "Oh, I don't think we could do it."
May I ask one question? No, I'm going to pass. I just thought it through. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to call on Janet Streff now. To talk about the stimulus funds, the most recent report, quarterly report on energy projects.
Okay, I guess I gotta read all these things. isn't Janet Stratford.
Sorry, I didn't provide you with that.
I won't be over for now. But maybe I'll see you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Streff. I'm manager of the State Energy Office in the Office of Energy Security. I'm here today to give you an update on the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act as it is unfolding in the energy area in Minnesota. It was about a year ago today that we were anticipating funding coming, and on February 17th of last year, the act was signed, and Minnesota is receiving just around $200 million for energy-related projects. So we fast forward through the work that we did through last year's session, and in May of last year, the Senate File 657 was signed, giving us direction on how to spend the funds. And I must thank the members of the committee and the legislature. I think we were one of the few states that did have input from their legislature, and in hindsight, I think it has helped us move forward even more quickly. We spent July through September receiving the first grants from the U.S. Department of Energy for the Weatherization Assistance Program, for the State Energy Program, and then for the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant, which was a new program passed in the last Energy Act and first appropriated with ERA funds. And one would think we could just get out and start doing the work right away, but I must admit we ran into many other national laws that I think gave us some hurdles and barriers to overcome that we had not anticipated. Prevailing wage requirements, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the National Historic Preservation Act were the three that have kept us busy this year. The prevailing wage requirement, really, Davis-Bacon was required for all ERA funds, and it affected the Weatherization Assistance Program dramatically. The Weatherization Assistance Program historically has had an exemption from Davis-Bacon, so the U.S. Department of Labor did one of its quickest wage determinations in history, and in approximately 6 months came out with a wage determination for a weatherization worker. Minnesota actually got its wage determinations on September 3rd, which was, I think, the Friday before Labor Day, so truly we began work in earnest with all of the right numbers right after Labor Day. They already have done one revision, and we're looking at that going into effect in the next few weeks to a month. The U.S. Department of Labor also was quite busy with looking at how Davis-Bacon affected homeowners on the state energy program and the block grant level or programs. With Davis-Bacon affecting all ERA funds, the question was, well, what about rebates to homeowners? Are homeowners then going to be required to make sure that they submit their certified payroll sheets for the work? And actually, in November, the U.S. Department of Labor came out with a determination that the Davis-Bacon did not apply for both renewable energy and energy efficiency on aid to individuals. So we've got that pretty well under control, and we've moved forward with that. The National Environmental Policy Act, I think, is probably the one that has held back the state energy program and the block grant.
Going back to the weatherization programs. Projects,
certainly.
How much of those funds have been distributed, expended?
Oh, let's see. Oh, you didn't put a number in, Mr. DeFeuve.
It's a number that lags.
It is.
Am I getting ahead of you? Is it something you're going to cover?
We are. And you can look it up in there while I'm talking about the others. Let me just go through the barriers really quickly. The NEPA one is a barrier in that we needed to get categorical exclusions for large pieces of work that we wanted to do. And an exclusion meaning that a project that we were going to be working on would not harm the environment. It's taken quite a while for the U.S. Department of Energy to do it. However, we did get our categorical exclusions in large part for our state energy program. We've submitted them for our block grant, and they're substantially the same, so we are not looking at, we're not expecting any additional difficulties with that. The Historic Preservation Act requires requires all buildings that are 50 years or older to undergo a review. And again, we are doing at a minimum 16,000 homes in weatherization, to say nothing of the multiple school buildings and local office, local units of government buildings that we'd be working on. And so we have hired a preservation specialist. We're working with our State Historical Preservation Office with to do a memorandum of understanding. And we're hoping that we should be able to have a pretty quick process that will allow us to ensure that the homes are not of historical significance, and we can go ahead and do the weatherization on them. So where are we today? The Weatherization Assistance Program. And I guess we are going more by our production rather than money spent, and there are a couple reasons for that. The large one is that the average cost per household changed with ERA. Previously, we were held to about $3,000 on average for a house. The ERA changed it to $6,500 on average for a house. We are not spending $6,500 on a house to get it to a good weatherization at this point. It's closer right now to about $4,000 a home. So our production is going to be more than that the DOE is requiring us to do. This slide, and it shows we've done, you know, almost, 3,678 homes. Obviously, it changes daily. But this was from July 1st through the end of January, so they're pretty up-to-date numbers. The interesting thing, however, is that the red is our regular DOE weatherization money that we received. And so while we were waiting for our Davis-Bacon determinations to come, we asked our community action agencies and our service providers to ramp up, to move forward, and use the department, the regular DOE funding. So you can see then the blue is the ERA funding, and that's obviously been going to a higher level once we got those wage determinations. As of January 31st, we've completed just over 2,000 homes. With the DOE regular money, we've completed almost 1,700 homes, and we have approximately, and again, it keeps moving, but we have about 2,000 homes that are just in progress. So that's in addition. The completed homes are audited, the work is done, they've signed off, and we've paid for everything. So that's at the very end. But we've got many. We've got 2,000 homes that are in some stage of completion, and so we use that as another marker of our progress that we're doing to date.
That's still a long shot from the 16,000 homes, though. Do you anticipate being able to use the funds within the time frame that we have to use them?
Madam Chair, absolutely. As we said, we really started with the ERA funds in September. So we've done 2,000. Typically, with the funds that we've received, we've been doing 3,000 to 3,500 homes a year. So in a quarter or less, we've already surpassed
that.
What
was the holdup with the prevailing wage? I mean, we know what the prevailing wage is, don't we?
Madam Chair, no, they did not. The weatherization worker is a completely new classification for Davis-Bacon. They do insulation work, they do some carpentry work, but they weren't insulators, they weren't carpenters, and so they did amalgamation of what a weatherization worker actually might do. And then The determination is done on a county-by-county basis. It was a nationwide county-by-county determination. So it took 6 months for that to come to pass.
That seems unreasonable.
One other thing I'd like to say on the weatherization is that in January, the U.S. Department of Energy came into our state and gave us an award for being in the top five states for production. So,
in production, meaning the number of units completed,
the number of units
energy efficiency met, or what?
Madam Chair, it's the number of units completed using the ERA funding. So the 2,000 at that time, I think it was almost 1,400. And we were in the five top states. So there are many states who are having a bit of trouble getting their programs started.
So what is the deadline for using the funds?
Madam Chair, we actually have a three-year contract with the U.S. Department of Energy for the ERA funds. So 2012 is the end date. However, we anticipate using those funds far before that. We're ramping up to a production number for weatherization of approximately 800 homes per month that should get us to that end date sometime in 2011.
And are you measuring the energy efficiency that you're accomplishing? I mean, do we not have to report on energy savings that are occurring?
Madam Chair, yes. The Department of Energy provides us with an algorithm that they have developed that gives them a sense of the amount of energy that is being saved by the program. We need to have time passed from the time that we went in there and did the work until we can assess it again. So we are working internally on a program that is going to help us determine that using pre and post numbers, but that obviously hasn't happened yet.
That's something that you'll communicate to us, though, as you start to acquire those numbers?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that. It would probably be more along the line of next year that we'd be getting those numbers pulled together.
Okay.
Yes.
For the State Energy Program and the Block Grant Program, we have several active programs. We have several programs that we are just beginning to roll out. So let me go through those quickly. Because we were awaiting our NEPA determinations for the State Energy Program, we first put our focus on residential programs because those were initially categorically excluded from NEPA. And we've worked on two programs that have been quite successful. The first one was a contract with the Builders Association of Minnesota in conjunction with the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. Project Re-Energize is the name of the program. We provided them with $3 million. It was an unreserved rebate program that allowed a homeowner to work with a contractor to do air sealing or insulation or to install windows. We have paid out 748 rebates to date for a total of $1.57 million. You can see that there's 5,641 windows that we replaced. We found that there was the average rebate was just under $2,000 that has been paid out, while the contractors were reporting a contract with a homeowner of about $10,000. So definitely there was money being leveraged. Again, this program has been receiving national attention. The National Association of Home Builders was quite interested in it, actually talked with the U.S. Department of Energy. The White House Council of Environmental Quality has contacted our Builders Association to find out more about the program. And we understand that it is a basis of part of their what they're calling cash for Cockers in this jobs bill that may actually come to pass as a part of it.
I just don't remember this being a part of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Is this something the Housing Finance Agency had promoted?
Madam Chair, there is a phrase in there that says, work with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and other entities to develop finance energy efficiency improvements in dwellings. The other program is with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, where we worked with them to develop a program that's somewhat similar to the Project Re-Energize, in that a homeowner who accesses the fix-up fund, and that's with a family income of $96,500 or less, then could also access rebates of up to $10,000 if they get that fix-up fund loan. And we provided them with $4.4 million. The contract, the program started in early December, and we've had 440, I think, rebate eligible loans applied for to date. It's been a very successful program in that several homeowners that did not access the Project Re-Energize were funneled towards the MHFA Energy Savers Program as well.
Ms. Streff, the BAM project is completed now?
It is. It is not quite completed. The homeowners had to show their intent to do a rebate, and I believe we have not finally. We haven't paid out all of the money that that they had requested, but for all intents and purposes, it is. We did try and put some safeguards around it so that we weren't going over dramatically the $3 million that we had allocated for it.
Have you calculated how many jobs it created?
Madam Chair, yes, we have. There were just under 40 jobs, 36.7, I believe. The job calculation for ERA is a strange animal, I would say. We report on a quarterly basis in accordance with Section 1512 of ERA, and those jobs are calculated on the number of hours that are worked and then divided by however many number a full-time job, a full-time equivalency is. So their intent was so that they weren't duplicating. So if somebody spent 1 hour, that you weren't calling that a full job that was created. We report this on a quarterly basis, and so the numbers are only good for that quarter, which personally I think is confusing. However, last quarter we did report 346 jobs created for the Weatherization Assistance Program, 36 jobs for the State Energy Program. The quarter before, all told, there was, I think, just under 170 jobs created. Another program that actually the contract was just signed last week, and so it will be rolling out, is the contract with the St. Paul Port Authority, what they are calling their Trillion BTU project. So that was for $5 million, and they should be ramping that up as well. And then just this week, we were able to roll out our residential solar rebate program. And again, we had waited until we got our ruling from the U.S. Department of Labor on whether rebates for homeowners needed to come under Davis-Bacon.
Madam Chair, can I just pipe up?
Sure,
for
Senator
a
Anderson.
Ms. Streff mentioned the St. Paul Port Authority Trillion BTU program, and I just want to clarify that is being run by the St. Paul Port Authority in cooperation with Xcel, and it will serve
commercial industrial customers all across XL service territory. So it's for about half the state of Minnesota that will be available to do those kinds of energy efficiency improvements. It's not just a St. Paul program. I just want to be clear about that. It's for about half the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Or half the customers, I should say.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And some of the questions that you've been asking, I think it's really important that we get this information. I don't know if we want it at the end of when all this is happening or if we can get maybe some interim reports so we can, you know, not that we can do anything to change what you're doing, but just to see kind of the gauge the project and maybe be able to report even to our constituents, too, on energy savings and job creation. I think that's important, even with the billion BTU or trillion BTU program, to kind of see how these programs are working so we can start forecasting or planning ahead which ones are seeming to get the best return on as we go forward in making our plans. So,
and that's why I'm asking the questions, because this is the second quarterly report. And we will be receiving quarterly reports. Okay. Ms. Streff.
Certainly. As I mentioned, there are several open RFPs and contracts that are almost at completion or are in some level of completion. A couple that aren't on here that I realize that I want to mention. We are in final contract negotiations for the outreach program that was in Chapter 138, and fully expect that in the next week or so to be completed. We have completed two of our contracts with our weatherization training and curriculum development, and one is in final negotiations, so we're ending up with three contractors for that. Our emerging renewable industries solicitation was very successful. We received many people and businesses that were interested. We do have a short list and are starting, once that short list is completed, we'll be starting final negotiations with that. The Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant competitive grant process, which is for the 60% of the funding that we receive for the block grant to the smaller cities and counties, that closed last week. It was for $6.4 million. We are reviewing those entries and will be determining the next steps once that review is finished. The commercial, industrial, and nonprofit energy efficiency and renewable energy grant program is currently open right now. Letter of intent, I think, was due mid to late January, and the final bids are due the end of this week, I believe. The state buildings energy efficiency program, the interagency agreement, is underway and should be moving over there probably next week, I think, is when it should be over there. The Duluth energy efficiency program, I believe, is this week.
They are so ready to start, but they've been afraid to hire a coordinator because they're not sure when the funding's coming through. So,
Madam Chair, that's then they have heard us. I think Jeremy is the one who's been doing the negotiations, so he may have some elucidation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebri, and I'm the SEP and EECPG program supervisor. Actually, one of my staff people, Danny Nadeau, has been doing the negotiations with folks with the city and with Common Ground. And we are getting closer to having a firmer scope of work than that we could put into a contract. It has been a bit more protracted process than any of us had hoped, but I think we are very close to being there. I will be up at the Energy Design Conference in Duluth the week after next, I believe it is, and I would hope to be carrying a contract for signature then.
Good. We have the Green Jobs Task Force meeting on Friday, and maybe I can report to them.
We're also working on a similar contract with Park Rapids, and then there's also the contract with Chisago that is underway.
What do you think the opportunity for recycling the money is going to be on these projects?
Madam Chair, there are a couple of projects that have been structured to be a revolving loan. I think it's the St. Paul Port Authority is one. Duluth maybe also is one. But many of them were in Chapter 138 required to be grant programs, rebate programs, so they will not have funding coming back to us. Also on the CNI with the 501c3s, a component of it is asking the local EDAs to have a component of it as a revolving loan fund.
Couple of questions here. Senator Jungbar and then Senator Dahl.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, since you got to ask about Duluth, I would ask more specifics on the Chisago one that I've been working with Chris Eng on. Any update on when a contract might be expected on that one?
Mr. DeFebre.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, I would presume that, as far as I know, we've pretty much got the scope of work nailed down. I think it needs to wait to be executed until the next Chisago County Board meeting. If memory serves, that's the third week of the month, and I would presume that that's when we'll have it signed.
Senator Jungbauer?
Chair, members, just so people know, these guys have gone I guess you could even say quite literally pulled their hair out over trying to meet all these requirements to get some of our local communities some of these grant monies. So I really appreciate the hard work that they've gone through, because I know the exercise that it's been for them. And it's sad that our federal folks haven't worked a little better to get those monies on the ground quicker.
Well, I think they've been moving along, too.
Okay, whatever Madam Chair
Senator
says.
Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was on the CNI grants. Do you expect that you will let out all of that $4 million with the requests that you've gotten in?
Madam Chair, Dahl, the grant solicitation is due on the 12th, so we do not know which ones we have received.
Oh, okay. I guess my question, Madam Chair, is that are you receiving a lot of requests, you know?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I believe there were multiple notices of intent filed.
Okay.
Mr. DeFebre?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, typically with an end date or a submission date on Friday, we would see at most a handful by now. So it wouldn't be a good gauge. When you have an end date, this was certainly the way I proceeded in high school, was that was the day that it got done.
Yeah. The reason I'm asking, Madam Chair, is I put a letter in the paper just to, you know, advertise that, you know, talked about what's going on with some of the energy efficiency that Pepsi-Cola bottling plant did down in Burnsville, and then suggested, hey, you know, other businesses could take advantage of this grant, but I knew we had a deadline. I'm just curious to see if, you know, anybody was responding or if there was a good response across the state. So,
yeah, along with that, I'm wondering what kind of efforts you've had in promoting these and coordinating these competitive grants.
Madam Chair, I think an example would be the EECBG competitive grant. We worked a great deal with the Association of Minnesota Counties, with the League of Minnesota Cities, and to a lesser extent with the Townships organization to both craft the program, provide some workshops and outreach in order to help people understand what was going to be provided and what they would need to do to be prepared, and then worked with those organizations in getting the word out on to their constituencies that the programs were available. On On a broader note, we do use an email listserv from our website where anybody can provide an email address and they will get notifications of in their interest area when a solicitation is released.
Madam Chair, I think at the end of our report, we do have a section on there of how the contacts we've tried to make, the people who have contacted us, how we've tried to do outreach on it as well.
I think we had an effort in there, though, to make sure that it got out into the rural communities and greater Minnesota and that they were notified and understood that they could compete for these grants. And I'm just wondering if there was advertising done or how they get notified.
Madam Chair, on our outreach grant, on the training grants, where we wanted to have something that was definitely statewide, we have received statewide participation in actually all of the grant solicitations that we've had. There's been statewide interest. Coming up is, once the slide before has all of those get out and digested, but coming up will be a large one for the money that's both for the state energy program and the block grant money being used for schools and local governments for building retrofits. We also intend next to be looking at getting out a rebate program for residential wind and ground source heat pump installations. We are first targeting the residential again because of NEPA limitations.
That's pretty nice.
Oh,
Madam Chair,
sorry,
you're talking.
Senator
Rosen.
Sorry. Clipping along here pretty good. No, on the school, on the school, the school RFPs that are coming out, what are the stipulations on that? Does it have to be a certain age, a size? Are you going to do the grants role? I mean, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm going to let Mr. DeFebri talk about that because they did go into some depth in deciding that.
Mr. DeFebri.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, while we're still putting together that RFP, we have looked at both geographic distribution, size distribution as far as smaller, both cities, counties, and school districts being able to compete for a certain amount of money against similar-sized institutions rather than trying to compete against the St. James School District competing against the city of Minneapolis. They don't have the same resources to put together grant applications, mm-hmm. perhaps. So we are doing some segmenting of the pots in order to have a minimum amount that smaller entities and non-metro entities can compete for. And we are essentially looking at the value of the energy savings for the dollar of grant invested, not necessarily at looking for certain size buildings or certain age buildings. It is what is the energy and dollar return on a dollar of grant dollars or dollar of grant requested.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
These schools, are they going to have some assistance with these grants? Are they going to be fairly easy to fill out? Is the Department of Ed going to assist with that, or your department?
Mr. DeFebri?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I would hesitate to speak for the Department of Education on what they will or won't do. We will probably be providing workshops to any entities on walking them through what the requirements are, both on a administrative and a technical basis. Depending on the type of measure that they're proposing, what we can provide them with the information that they need to gather to put into an application that allows us to evaluate its effectiveness. And the more complicated measure they have, we would strongly encourage them to contract with somebody that is familiar with that. You look at control systems, you look at boiler replacements, those sorts of things. It is almost imperative to have a PE do those analyses because we can't do them from afar, and you can't expect the staff people at a school to be able to handle that either.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Could you recommend to your school districts to go to your website to get the information that's on your website, and they can start planning on a grant application?
Mr. DeFebvre?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. I would have to check exactly what we have in that under public buildings on our website to say. I know that we have, in the context of ECBG, provided information similar to that. I don't know whether we've created a pathway that says schools enter here, and if we haven't, we will.
Senator Olstein.
Chair, thank you. Would this be things like maybe redoing a roof and having more insulation installed, or new windows on the school? Is there some kind of boilers?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Madam Chair, Senator Olstein, certainly those are the types of activities that are allowable, and we are likely to see, I would think, windows, lighting improvements, control improvements, new boilers, burners, other envelope measures. I think that would make up the bulk of what types of applications we would find.
Mr. F., how much is left of your report?
Not much.
Okay. I was really wanting to gavel us closed at 5:30, so maybe if you could wrap it up.
I sure can. We are doing, as I said, ground source heat pumps and small wind. NEPA, the categorical exclusions are those that are showing, and so larger ground source heat pumps and larger wind are somewhat of an issue because we are looking at, for a larger project, to be going in to the U.S. Department of Energy for an environmental interpretation, worst case, perhaps an environmental impact statement. So it becomes an issue of how fast can we get money out and how much energy saved or energy generated would this project do. So we have not moved forward on the larger renewables side. We did get a couple of grants that were not in Chapter 138, but I just wanted you to know about them. We did get some money for energy assurance, and we are working with our regional states to plan continuity with the grid, energy resiliency. It's giving us money to work more closely with our homeland security folks to make sure that we know what to do in case of an emergency.
I'm glad you brought that up because it was a question I wanted to ask on transmission about whether there was accommodations for demand side energy and for smart grid and things like that.
Madam Chair, I think every group is working on smart grid right now.
Okay.
And then the last I want you all to know about is our Minnesota Trade-In and Save Appliance Rebate Program that will be going live March 1st. There is a website on the next slide, but basically we are going with white goods refrigerators where you can get up to $200, $100 if you do it when you purchase it, and another $100 if you do recycle it. The same for freezer, only it's $50 and $50, $200 for a clothes washer and $150 for a dishwasher. We think there'll be 25 to 30,000 rebates available. We've contracted with Helgeson Enterprises, a Minnesota business, who is doing the rebate processing. DOE has required us to limit it to one rebate per household, so you can't get your whole suite of appliances with this option. But it's MinnesotaApplianceRebate.com is where you can go starting March 1st to sign up for it. All currently current eligible Energy Star appliances are on the list, and we have been working with all of our utilities as they've ramped up all of their programs to make sure that recycling programs are available. And so it's utilities, many counties have them, as well as several of the retailers. And as one of the staff has mentioned, the retailers definitely are ramping up the work that they're doing on this now, and you can already get some pretty good deals on the appliances. So that's what's going on.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you then for the presentations. And I'm sorry that we didn't get to all the reports. We will be hearing the report on telecommunications and the stimulus funds on Thursday before our bill hearing. And Mr. Glahn, we'll have to get to you at another time. Okay. Meeting adjourned.
Everyone's invited.